here coming down to the International Space Station to an inspection and or fixing of the tiles before safely coming back to the Earth. That scenario is out of the question by 10 to 1 in inclination of orbit. So you either go straight to the Hubble and come back home, or you go straight to the International Space Station and come back home. You don't visit one to the other. You don't do satellite hopping. The physics there is just out of sight. That's bad news. So, one last guess Paul. Hubble will give us a good service up until what year? Your best guess as to what year Hubble will be pretty bad shape. 2017? 2018? What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
The most they ever expected was 7 years. I mean, they never got that, but that's what they always hoped for. So that gives you 2016. Things start to fail. Batteries fail, electronics fail, and then the gyros, that's very important. They start to fail. Solar panels, no big deal with that. I mean, those are brand new solar panels that they had put on there. Up in 1990, here we are in 2013, so you're looking at 23 years of service. There's been 5 repair missions there. So it's averaging, every 4 or 5 years. They're hoping to get 7 years out of it. And they were pushing their luck last time. The last one, I think they probably got up to 6. I think they were failing. It took them a while to get going, to get that mission. They practiced for a couple of years, but it took a couple of years to do that kind of practicing back then.
Oh, well. I'm a Hubble lover. And in the case of an astronaut where the family is suing, you run into a very difficult situation. If a person knows somewhat precisely when he's about to die because of somebody's failure, you can sue and get a lot of money. Here we are knowing something about when Hubble is going to die, but it's not a human being. Okay, so I hope you get some good pictures. I know that they've taken both the deep field picture, the ultra deep field picture, and I think the extreme deep field picture, where you aim Hubble into one particular point in space, just sit there and integrate, gather more and more photons, and when you do, you see thousands and thousands of galaxies you've never seen before, which you think is an empty piece of space, ain't empty. And in that situation, you're looking at an area of space that's a very small fraction of the azimuth and elevation of the moon, the number of degrees swept by the moon. So if you had enough hardware to make an ultra deep field or an extreme deep field picture of every single chunk of space, which would be many thousands of the moons, because it's 41,250 square degrees on the surface of a sphere, if you're taking an ultra deep field picture 1 degree at a time, you're going to take 41,000 pictures, and each one of them is 1 million seconds or 10 million seconds long. You ain't going to live hard enough, and your hardware ain't going to live hard enough, and you ain't got enough hardware to do all that. So astronomy-wise, you could say we're just scratching the surface. Here we are, lots of years downrange. Oh, well.
Question, Dick?
Go ahead, I recognize the voice. Is it John? Whoever you are, you know who you are. KQLIW.
Yeah, I used to know who I was when I started here. Quick question. If they can build a deorbiting device, why can't they build that device and just lower the orbit, bring it down to a serviceable area, do what they have to do, and then use that same device to put it back up in orbit? That's one question. I have a second one. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I will admit you're putting your astronauts at fairly high risk of the Van Allen belt. Put them up to the altitude of Hubble in order to do a repair. So, should we build a better radiation safety space suit? Hubble where it is? Hubble is an extremely heavy piece of hardware. To bring it down to a low altitude, do the repair, and bring it back up to a high altitude, on paper that sounds good. I'm a little worried that that's a very expensive series of two or three missions to do all that. I'd rather see them build a Dean Kamen-type, very elaborate robot, highly manipulatable set of hand-like devices, and the robot goes up there and does the mission and takes its own sweet time. I'd rather see that. But I'm with you. Let's find a way to keep repairing Hubble. I don't think we should bail out on it, because it's getting better and better. That's the biggest piece of glass we have ever put in space. I'm talking about that beautiful parabolic mirror. Yes, it had an error. But by way of the optical correction, the spectacles, as they call it, they put on there, that problem went away. So I'm with you. Let's not give up with Hubble. Got any other ideas for keeping Hubble forever, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Conan, WS2N.
I think that we should take every effort. It's a shame to junk it. A lot of technology, and we've gotten a lot of benefits from it. But we've got a couple of years. Maybe they will come up with something. But sending men up that high, no, I don't think so. I think bringing the instrument down, that's probably doable. Quite expensive, I would imagine. My second question is, I have not been able to get any information on the asteroid and the meteor that passed here, especially the one in Russia. Do you know if it hit the ground? I know there were like 1,200 people injured and stuff. Anybody on that has any information on what went on? I missed that whole scenario. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to pass it over to Paul for both of those answers. But I did see a couple of news reports in which they estimated how big was the piece that landed in Russia, that hit the atmosphere in Russia, created that great big shockwave. To my knowledge, small pieces of it did land and were picked up. And the problem was the scientists trying to pick up the pieces were in competition with the citizens picking up pieces because they wanted them as souvenirs and they wanted to resell them. So there was a bit of conflict there, but there were some small pieces that came down. So over to you, Paul, for comments on all of the above. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they showed a hole in the lake, too. It went into a lake, you know, frozen up there. Ice went right through it. And they had pieces of all. I did see people picking them up, every tiny piece, you know, maybe the size of a quarters, you know, very, very small. But there must be something sizable that went into that lake. And, you know, whether they get that out, or when they get that out, I don't know when that's going to happen, if at all. I don't even know how deep the lake is. Might be shallow, might be deep. I know it came at 40,000 miles an hour, according to head of the planetarium, Tyson. Neil deGrasse Tyson said that. And I was going to say something else. The Hubble. Oh, yeah, you're probably closest to being right. If they ever do anything, it's a money thing. It would be robotic to get to the Hubble thing. There was plans. I mean, there's hardware that was being built and tested, and you know, you go out 5-6 years, and that thing's still running. And if there's money, somebody will do it. It's not like the space shuttle. The space shuttle is very expensive. I mean, just to launch a space shuttle without even planning anything, it's a $500 million job. Just, you know, $500 million just to put a space shuttle up into orbit without even saying what we're doing with it, never mind going out to a Hubble or actually doing a mission, what that would add on to it. Very expensive. Let me drop it. The money might not be there. Like you said, the beginning of March, you're going to have facts maybe. A couple of years from now, maybe they'll have some more money, maybe less money, who knows. They're always getting cut little by little at NASA. I think it could be a problem because they had trouble funding the new one, the James Webb, you know, it's a 10-year project. But it's still costing $18 billion, $18 billion to put that thing together. I don't know if the country's going to support another, you know, couple hundred million dollars or maybe billion-dollar robotic trip up just to save the Hubble. You know, I have to put in another $18 billion into that thing, and including some of the other countless telescopes that we have flying around, Spitzer and all these other Kepler. These costly missions that have been put up there over the years. It might be hard to sell, even economically, but feasibly to do it, I think you're right, Dick. That would be the only shot, and probably doable. I mean, especially a couple of years from now. WS2M.
I've got another way of going around this one, Paul. You've listed to us three or four major companies, independent of NASA, that are building space shuttle substitute hardware, manned hardware. So if there are three or four commercial organizations willing to spend their own money to develop space hardware, manned space hardware, I think it's time we try to talk one of those commercial companies into building a robot repair piece of hardware. One of those companies can build a rotor repair. You've got a lot of things in geosynchronous orbit that are all slowly, all the stuff in geosynchronous orbit is all slowly running out of fuel. And all of those are in the exact same orbital plane. So the possibility of a robot repair mission that doesn't come back to Earth, but goes up to geosynchronous orbit, and visits as many of those geosynchronous satellites as it can before it runs out of fuel, and refuels all of them. Because of the price of putting hardware in geosynchronous orbit, because of the usefulness of them, I see a definite need to consider repairing them on one-way repair missions, robots. So isn't it time we try to talk some commercial companies into launching that kind of a piece of hardware? Put Dean Kamen on board so that he's building some kind of a hand manipulator that's equally as good as a human being. And that hand manipulator doesn't give a damn about radiation hardening, doesn't worry about the Van Allen belt, doesn't worry about a one-way mission to a 22,300-mile orbit, and it's never going to come back. And then it goes to the graveyard. So is that possible, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, in the future, you've got SpaceX is really in the lead. They have what they call the heavy lift Falcon. Essentially, the Falcon 9 rocket is the one that they use to put Dragon up to the space station. And they're able to bring a little over 1,000 pounds to the space station each time. But they do have the heavy lift, and it's really tricky Falcon 9 bolted together. And they'll be able to go up to geosynchronous orbit and, you know, onto, they have plans on doing a planetary flight. So they do have a contract to put, a geosynchronous satellite up with that, one of those missions. That's about a year away. They have lift capability. I don't, you know, they would have to sign up with somebody that developed the robotic equipment to do this work. I don't see them doing it unless another commercial company would get involved with that. I know GM is really involved with robotics with NASA. I know Canada has done a lot of work with the robotic arms. They have them on the space station. They have them on the shuttle. Drop it. So, you know, I mean, sure, that's a possibility, but they would be the one. Future ones, Boeing, I don't know what their lift capability will be to get the geosynchronous orbit or not. Probably, right now their plans are just to send manned missions to the space station. And for that matter, that's the immediate plan for SpaceX, although they do have some private, and I think they signed up for a military contract as well, for not too distant future. So they might be the best ones to do it. You've got Orbital Science launching from, going to be launching from Wasp Island, unmanned missions to the space station with the Antares rocket. I don't think that thing's going to be powerful enough to get to geosynchronous orbit, so they might be out. Same thing with, you know who might be able to do it? Sierra Nevada out of Colorado, drop it. Because they have plans on, they had plans on launching on the Atlas V rocket. I think they have the capability of signing up with another contract, going a couple of different ways, but they do have plans on launching on a heavy lift vehicle, the Atlas V, that can go to geosynchronous orbit. And they'll go out of Wallops Island as well. So, they'd have to launch from Cape Kennedy. They'd have to go down to Florida to match that 28 degree for the Hubble. But they'd also have to do that for geosynchronous orbits. Another one that might help out is European Space Agency. They launch very close to the equator. They launch the Ariane 5. They put anything up into space or out of into interplanetary missions. That would be a good group to help. They have terrific launch. Every one of their launches is very successful. So might get them involved. The ESA. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Thomas.
Transmitting the wrong mic. Go right ahead, John.
Dick, don't you think it's about time? Maybe they're already considering it, but the design of the spacecraft, batteries, gyros, communications equipment, they should go modular, standardize it, so that we can build a robot that would be able to perform its task on almost anything that's sent up, and we could save a lot of these manned missions. Everything could be relegated to robotics. What do you think of that?
BC2QAQ.
Glenn recognized. Glad to hear from you. No, you're absolutely right. It's time we build better and better robots. When it comes to fighting war with so-called drones, we have saved a large number of American lives, removed an awful lot of the risk of conducting warfare by way of those really robots that are called drones. So if we can do it on the surface of the Earth, I know we can do it in space. See what Glenn's got to say about all that. And I know I gave you some material much too late today. Now, here we go. Greg, so if you had a chance to see it, what do you think? KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I was trying to get in before on the 8-5 machine. I guess it wasn't receiving me, but I guess on the seldom. Are you hearing me clear on this repeater?
Very well, Glenn, so please proceed.
Yeah, basically, I think robots are the way to go. I think the space program over the years, I think it was, you know, certainly the sentimental part about having manned space missions. Certainly to the moon, it was very important, I think, to have people, you know, land and step on the moon. But I think for a lot of the more scientific ventures in the future, and things like Hubble-like experiments, certainly having non-manned vehicles, that is certainly a better way of doing repair. Makes more sense. You don't have to worry about carrying all the life support systems. I certainly think that that's a much better way of going. As far as the EM wave material, I have been reading it, so if there's any questions or anything you had on that, fire away, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Very fine, Glenn. Taking things in order. We all forget about what tremendous amount of resources it takes to maintain a human being in space. The way you guys have heard me say it quite often in the past, which really puts a big hole in the philosophy of an awful lot of our youth. Most of the kids in high school today are dreaming about the day that one of their contemporaries, as an astronaut, will be standing on Mars. And I don't think my great-grandchildren stand a chance of that happening. The reason for that is that we all forget about what it takes to maintain a human being. A Mars mission is round trip around 3 years. And each year of your life, you, as a human being, consume an amount of water, food, and and air, oxygen, that has the mass of your house and approximately the volume of your house. That's how much stuff flows through you per year. Can you imagine having three houses worth of stuff per astronaut on a mission to Mars? The logistics of that is extremely difficult. And the first thing everyone will say is, well, we'll recycle. Well, think about that slowly. You literally have to recycle every single molecule of fluid and solid and gas that goes through and comes out of a human being. Every one of those molecules has to be recycled. We forget about the fact that every breath that we take on this planet contains air molecules that were once inside of the lungs of every one of the human beings that have ever walked on this planet. All those air molecules on this planet are being recycled. All the waste products you put out are being recycled. Mother Nature takes 100 or 1,000 years to do it, but she does it. And you got a thing called Earth, a very big thing that can do that. And you got a lot of time. Let me drop. But you try to design a piece of hardware that recycles every single molecule with high fidelity. And if any portion of that recycling machinery breaks down, it's game over. So you don't want to send human beings to these wicked places. And Mars, you look at these pretty pictures being sent down by Curiosity, and you think you want to be there. Go slow. That place is 150 degrees below zero in temperature, 300 or 400 mile an hour winds, a fraction of 1% of the Earth's atmosphere, no Van Allen belt, no protection, radiation from the solar wind like you wouldn't believe. It's the coldest, driest, wickedest desert you could ever imagine. You don't want to send a human being there. To send a robot there, yes. So, it's got to be robots. All these repair missions, eventually, we're doing such a beautiful job of using robots in warfare on Earth, it's time we start using robots on Earth. To me, it's obvious, but that's a strongly felt opinion. You guys may have some other opinion. Now, with reference to the material that I mailed you today, which I know I mailed you much too late. Let me drop. I indicated that on page 10 and 11, as I remember, the bottom of one page and the top of the next page, they talk about what that wave looks like in space, where they show an animation, and I've given you an applet that also shows you an animation, where, yes, the E field and the H field are at right angles to each other, spatially, and much of the respected literature I can find says they are in time sequence. They reach peak at the exact same instant. And you were saying last Sunday, Glenn, that you believe that that's a bit of a misinterpretation. There really is a quadrature in time for the timing of the E and the H. I thought that's sort of what you were saying last week, among other things. KC2QIQ, K2IW.
Yeah, I think there's really two ways of looking at this. The first one is in the representations that you had there, both of which are correct, but they're saying different things. When you're looking at what that article is representing, everything is referred to Maxwell's equation, and it's looking at cross-sectional areas. So when you're looking at the cross-section of the of an electromagnetic wave in a wavefront, where the D vector in that diagram is facing towards you, then yes, they will be directly in phase. So in other words, when you're looking at an antenna in free space, then the antenna is going to be in a cross-section area, that yes, at that particular point in time, you will have a maximum of the E and the HE field in directly in phase.
Okay, so therefore, the 90-degree shift that you were somewhat talking about last week and the week before, I now sense that you're saying it's a matter of how you look at it. If I make a three-dimensional diagram, I've got a couple of cubic feet of space that I'm analyzing, and I've got this transverse electromagnetic wave propagating through it with the usual way of showing it as a red vectors up and down for voltage and blue vectors left and right for the H field. And whether I take that three-dimensional diagram and twist it so that the z-axis of propagation is aimed directly toward me or aimed 30 degrees away from me, aimed at right angles to me, or going away from me, and I look at it from the top back side or whatever, I don't think the way you look at it changes the fact that the E and the H are in spatial quadrature and temporal coincidence. Whether I look at it top, bottom, left, right, plan view, isometric view, or whatever, I think those two facts stay the same. I think you're saying something different now, but I'm not sure. Over to you, Glenn. KGRIW.
Yeah, actually, I am saying exactly that, Dick. When you're looking at the electromagnetic wave in free space, you're not looking at a cross-section. Now you're looking at a balanced EH field that's propagating in a bound. So it's no longer an area equation. It's not directly Maxwell's equation. It's Maxwell's equation moving in a third dimension. So when you're looking at those and the ones that are intersecting an antenna, you're only looking at basically something to the second power. You're not looking at that volume of something to the third power. When you put the third vector in, that's when you'll see that because there is no cross-section, that there is a lead lagging factor between D and H.
Okay, you said the word lead and lag factor between D and H, and that there was a convenient lag, maybe it's 90 degrees quadrature. I've got a problem now. The diagram doesn't show that. And now we've got two different representations, I'll admit. There's a degree of similarity and a degree of difference. The applet that I showed you a picture of, that when you press the word go, it keeps generating brand new red arrows and brand new blue arrows as if they're just being created at the leading edge of the wave. That's a misconception. They're not being recreated. The book describes it as this diagram of E and H, where you look at some number of waves, you freeze that in your mind, and when you allow time to start progressing forward, you take that whole structure and you slide it on the z-axis in the direction of propagation. So you generated the E and the H's way back at the antenna. They slide in the z-axis. Each one of those individual arrows, so to speak, each one of the individual vectors, and they slowly decrease in volts per meter and amps per meter as you get more and more distance from the transmitting antenna. That's the inverse square law. So they get slightly smaller, but they don't get regenerated at the leading edge, which is sort of what the applet is showing. But once I resolve that difference, once I accept the sliding phenomenon, shows the peak of E and the peak of H simultaneous at the same point, and shows the E and the H at right angles. So when you're talking about the phase shift between the two, I'm wondering what you're saying, Glenn. KCQQIQ, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm sure as you've already noticed that there's a lot of problems with that animation. It's not just the leading edge that's an error. The other thing is that if you look at the amplitudes of basically E field and H field over length, it's got some odd errors. They're not all the same amplitude. And then there's a third problem. Okay, the signal is started in the center and coming out from both sides. Well, if that's true, there you have a reinforcement effect from the antenna moving outwards. There is the E and the H field do not look uniform like that coming up of an antenna. And the only reason why I'm saying it's an antenna in the middle is because it's the only thing it could possibly be, some kind of a radiating source, because it can't be a reception antenna in free space, because then the wave would be coming at one direction and continuing in another direction, and you have to show a field of radiation path. In this particular case, you've got a sensor with something radiating outward, and it doesn't even demonstrate the differences in amplitude or the recombination of the field. And it's demonstrating in the applet of a square area, which doesn't make any sense either. Those, when you put all three together, the only thing I could probably suggest about that application that is that it's a very simplistic model that's part some teaching mechanism that's being used as part of a much larger discussion, and I'm sure that there are many, many other parts to that. So it's kind of like trying to put something out of context and try to use it for our discussion, which I don't think is going to work.
Okay, I've got another explanation of this one, Glenn. If I'm showing a simple dipole radiation pattern and I'm plotting amplitude versus direction in space, it's the classic toroid, a donut in space. And because you're putting some amount of signal across all 41,000 square degrees of space, that's a very difficult thing to show as a time diagram of E and H. However, if I was using a parabolic dish that creates a pencil beam where most of the energy is transmitted in one direction, then half of that moving applet works, the part that comes toward me. And you're troubled by the fact that it's got a wave traveling to the north at the same time it's got a wave traveling to the south. Now let me go the next step. You and I could generate a very large phased array of dipoles. I'm going to put 50 dipoles across a sheet, but I'm not going to put a reflector behind them. Without that reflector behind them, I'm making a pencil beam to the north, I'm making a pencil beam to the south. In that case, that moving applet with a wave going to the north and to the south does represent that reality. Let's talk about that one right there. Transmitting in two directions doesn't bother me, and I can generate a piece of hardware that can do that. I just described it. KC2QIQ,
K2RIW. I think I see where the misunderstanding is coming from. In other words, what you're trying to do is you're trying to make an electromagnetic wave move it in a direction that you can envision. And that's a mistake in itself. In other words, what you have to think about in the beginning is, what is the electromagnetic wave doing in free space? Now, whether it's if you start and understand single radiator, it's going to be a lot easier to understand what's happening in a directional radiator. But in this particular case, what I'm showing you there is that they're trying to normalize something into an area relationship. And it's not going to work. Like you said, it's far more complex than that. But we can simplify it and explain it on air. And I'm going to try to take the first step at attempting to do that this evening. But the following what I'm saying so far, in other words, that when you're looking at how the electromagnetic wave initially starts from the antenna, and then you look at it and view it in three space, in a three-dimensional diagram, it will become more obvious. And there's also something when you're looking at the area in Maxwell's equation, in a cross-section, what's actually happening is you're only looking at basically very similar to like an X and Y coordinate. You need that Z coordinate in order to really understand the position in free space. When you're intersecting into an antenna, keep in mind the antenna is intersecting at a cross section. So, and the antenna, yes, that's what it will look like. But not in free space. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, let's go one step at a time, do a little bit more divide and conquer. If I talk about the applet, the moving applet, and you're troubled by the signal going to the north and the signal going to the south, I sort of understand that. Let's just talk about the signal going to the north. And you and I are both troubled by the fact that the leading edge is generating brand new arrows. And I don't believe that. It's really all the exact same arrows, and they just slide. The wave propagates. If I'm using a very large parabolic dish that transmits a signal only to the north, a pencil beam signal, and if I look at the portion of the applet of only the signal coming toward me, and I forget about the one going in the other direction, would that pencil beam in a far field coming out of that big parabolic dish antenna be somewhat like that forward portion of the applet if I throw away those new arrows being generated at the leading edge? If I created that to a sliding applet, would that still be somewhat realistic to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
In free space, absolutely not. And I think you can understand this when I put this into words. The only difference between a directional antenna in free space and an omnidirectional antenna in free space is the amplitude in direction. So if you're looking at the amplitudes of B and H in one direction, they will be greater. There'll be more reinforcement. But that doesn't mean it's not radiating in the other direction. It just means that the signals that are radiating in other directions from the prime direction of your directional antenna are just going to be lower in amplitude. But you still have the same wave action in all directions, 360 degrees around that radiator, just lower in amplitude. KC2QIQ.
I'm going to agree with you on that one, Glenn. That's one of the hard subjects that you've just hit on that many of the people I work with, when we do antenna measurements, it's hard for people to believe. If I took it to the extreme, if you allowed me to make a parabolic dish that is almost an infinite number of wavelengths in diameter, where I'm able to generate a pencil beam that is a micro radian in azimuth and elevation wide, it really is an extremely sharp pencil beam, that in the near field, it's this huge area of this infinite diameter parabolic dish emitting the signal. And I go out there in the far field, I think I'm going to see a wave somewhat like that forward portion of that applet. I now know that in other directions, there's going to be nano, micro, signal radiated. But in the extreme, if you allow me to go a dish big enough in diameter, I can make a truly planar wave in essentially one direction and in no other direction. In the real world, it's going to be 60, 80 dB, 100 dB down in the other directions. I can almost ignore that as far as the diagram is concerned. The diagram is a little bit simplistic. It's not showing those 80 dB down signals in the other directions. With those extremes and limitations, does that applet then come close to showing what that wave would look like in free space? Without a doubt, it's overly simplistic, but it's at least coming close. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
That close at all, Dick. As I said, what's going to happen is you take an antenna and you move it around the dish. The only difference in the electromagnetic wave that you're going to detect is going to be amplitude. That's only the only difference. You may see some phase effect in terms of the polarization because of some craziness as you move around. The polarization may be affected, but here again, just because the polarization is changing, the only difference you're going to see in the antenna is amplitude. But the wave, as you move around, will still be the same, and will still be propagating the same, just lower in amplitude and possibly different possible polarizations. But that's it. That's the only real difference. Now, as the antenna is concerned, the antenna is viewing a cross-section, so the antenna sees what you see in that diagram. That's not how it's moving in free space.
I'm going to partially agree with that. You're absolutely right. Every real antenna, as you view it at crazy angles away from its bore site, electronic bore site, you always see signal. The back lobes, the side lobes, the top, the bottom, there's always radiation in all directions out of every real antenna. However, I have worked on antennas where the number of wavelengths of the dish is big enough that the main beam has less than 1 degree of beam width. You go half a degree to the right or the left, half a degree up or down from the bore site, and you're down 3 dB. Go a couple more degrees, and you're down 10, 15, 20 dB. I can make an antenna where away from the main lobe, everything is essentially 40 dB down. I didn't say it's zero, but it's so close to zero that I can make a overly simplistic applet diagram, and the forward section of that wave comes close to representing what's going on. There are some signals going in other directions, but they're so small, with the resolution you have with that applet, you essentially wouldn't see the signals going in those other directions. And by the way, the fact that there's some signals going in other directions doesn't change the fact that the main lobe presentation of that applet is telling me something. Yes, it's not showing me the non-main lobe. the athlete is not showing me the first and second side lobe, which I know is always there with real antennas. But if I'm only displaying the main lobe, and if I use a high enough performance antenna where the main lobe is 40 decibels above everything else, and with the right kind of a distribution, that is achievable. It's been done. Isn't that applet then coming close to demonstrating what that wave of that particular very narrowband main lobe would look like? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I think if I answered that, Dick, what's happening is the antenna will always see the area cross-section, which is going to match the Maxwell's equation, which is going to look like the squaring and your B and H are going to be in phase in the antenna, because only the antenna is always viewing a cross-section. But it's only looking at one cross-section of a square area. But the whole electromagnetic wave is three-dimensional. That's my point. So yes, the antenna will see that. But it doesn't matter whether you're in the pencil beam or you're off on the side. It will see the same thing no matter where you're viewing an electromagnetic wave. If you've got a quarter wave antenna or a half wave antenna and you move it around, you're going to always see a cross section that's always going to look similar to that diagram in the antenna, because the antenna is intersecting at a cross section. But still, one antenna in free space is not going to be looking at the whole three-dimensional image of the wave. That's what I'm trying to point out here. So now, the next question you should be asking me is, what type of antenna, or what could I do to measure the three-dimensional wave? That should be your next question, Dick.
When it comes to the instrumentation we use to make the measurements, without a doubt, it's disturbing everything. That applet is a kind of a thought experiment. It assumes that your eyes can see the wave that has been propagated. Of course, that's crazy. And it's a huge timing problem. In the real world, your eyes are looking at something that is delayed by, if it's a 1 foot wavelength of this transmitting your signal, wait a minute, 1 meter, 1 meter, 300 megacycle signal, it's a 3 meter wavelength. Every wavelength that I'm away from the thing that I'm looking at, I'm some number of microseconds delayed in time. So we're going to make the assumption that what your eye sees is the real E and H, and the eye has the ability to see them, and by some magic can see them with no time delay because of the distance between your eye and the portion of the wave you're looking at. So we're throwing away the time delay problem. We're throwing away the visualization problem that your eye can't really see this. But if my eye could see it, and if there was no time delay, and I'm only looking at the main lobe, and for the time being, I know that those side lobes are transmitting a tremendously weaker signal in some other direction. For the time being, I'm ignoring that, because even if I plotted it, it would be something very small, and it would only be a minor perturbation on what I see. With those restrictions that I've just described, does that diagram come close? And if the answer is no, you're a smart enough guy, can now tell me, if you were making that applet and you wanted it to be closer to reality, what would you change? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, there's a lot of things, as I said, because I don't believe that applet is describing what we're discussing. Okay, it's plus something else. And I've got some ideas of what it is, but I really don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole right now. But what I'm really going with this is this. When you take your antenna and you're looking at it in a dimension and it's intersecting an electromagnetic wave, it's going to be very, very similar to what you see there. It will be square. In which you're going to be looking at a cross-section where B and H are going to be in phase. But now let's talk about, we're going to make a special antenna now. As a matter of fact, we're going to make a lot of different elements, and we're going to be able to measure three-dimensional space. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a box of space that's going to be exactly one wavelength in all dimensions. Okay, so in other words, it's going to be somewhat spherical, in where you have some kind of a feed point in the center, and you've got elements that are basically looking in all three dimensions from the center. Are you following me?
I think I am. Please proceed.
Now, as that antenna is And we're just going to do it with one element in the beam. We're going to take the center of the sphere, and we're going to put the feed point in the middle. And what we're going to do is, and we're going to suggest that the middle of this antenna, with the middle where we're feeding it, is a ground plane. Are you following me there?
I think I am. Go ahead.
So it's a flat point ground plane, and we have a quarter wavelength antenna off of that. Now what we're going to do is we're going to feed a CW signal in space, and what we're going to do is we're going to synchronize the receiver to the CW signal so that we can kind of like lock the phase of the antenna so that it's always receiving the same basic synchronized phase, the receiver and the transmission that's taking place. So now what we're going to do is we're going to take snapshots of the antenna in a whole bunch of different positions. We're going to go straight up, straight down, straight back, straight forward, off at right angles, and rotate in as many possible dimensions as we possibly can. What do you expect is going to happen to the difference in amplitudes of DNH as you rotate that in all different crazy directions around that pivot center?
In the case of my idealistic 1 degree beam with pencil beam antenna, when I'm in the bore site and looking back into the antenna, I'm going to see some pretty potent DNH that are going to obey certain characteristics. When I take my point of view at some other azimuth and elevation with reference to the antenna during the transmitting, and I'm off of bore site, I'm again going to see E and H at right angles to each other. I'm going to see them at some slightly different timing, a hell of a lot weaker amplitude, and in some cases, because of the condon lobes, even some crazy polarizations. But much, much weaker is the significant part. When I go off of bore site, a large number of degrees, I'm going to see something that is so much weaker that if I ignored it, it's not a truth, but it's not that much of a lie, that the vast majority of the energy is in that 1 degree beam width and as an L main lobe at bore site. That's where 98% of the energy is located. And so I could restrict myself to that 98% of the energy, knowing full well that it transmits in other directions. And so here's a philosophy problem that you and I have got, Glenn. The real world is always many, many times more complicated than any of our models that we make to represent it. And so what kind of a person, let me drop, one kind of a person with a kind of an exacting personality will say, hey, everything you're showing is a lie. I don't accept any of it. Well, in that case, there's nothing you can accept, and you can't do anything. In reality, when you and I do anything, we do a simplification. I decide that I'm going to fix the spark plug of my car, and I go out there with a tool to remove the spark plug. In reality, and I estimate to my wife I'm going to be out there for a half hour. In reality, I can remove a bunch of hardware that I didn't anticipate before I can even get to the spark plug. I may have to take a special tool to remove the wiring to the spark plug. The real world is complicated. If I knew enough in the first place, I would never volunteer to fix the spark plug of the car. If I knew how bad it was going to be, I never would have gone to college. It was a hell of a lot worse in dollars and time and misery than I expected. But I'm glad I did. So everything in life is a simplification. Everything is a hell of a lot more complicated. We got to be careful not to use that as an entrap that forces us to do nothing. I know you're not going there, but you see where I'm going a little bit. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
I understand where you're coming from, and I'm going to try to make this mental picture of what this electromagnetic wave is looking like in free space. And what I'm trying to do is give you an idea that within a square wavelength, in other words, wavelength three sides, and you were to look at all polarizations and all amplitudes within there, you can basically trace out in three dimensions what the electromagnetic wave looks like in free space. These measurements that have been done, cosmetic, they're more commonly done with light than they are with radio waves that I'm familiar with, at least anyway, and some with optics. As a matter of fact, I was in a very impressive place in Pennsylvania that does tremendous light measurements, and we went through many of these calculations and other things and look at the, you know, the true, what real wave propagation looks like in three space, in free space. And what's really interesting about it is that you have a shifting of BNH over area, and it's the area, as you slide the cross-section and you look at what's actually happening across it, you'll see that what's actually happening is that you have a progression of the waves, and which, when you go into three dimensions, there is a shift in BNH of 90 degrees. Now, I can explain that to you also mathematically. If you look at basically a electrical circuit, and you look at something that's just sine omega t, then you look at something in the square, like the BNH waveform that you look there, you're looking at sine omega t square. Then when you're talking about the EM wave free space, now you're talking about sine omega t cube. Now, plotting BNH, they're not going to be in phase exactly at maxima and minima. KC2 is what I can
do. Going to give a little bit of an explanation here. For the people who are listening in, part of what's going on, Glenn and I are discussing a fairly respected, fairly deep technical textbook on electromagnetic waves. This textbook excerpt was mailed to me by Bill Saw, W2SAW, Kilo Delta 2, Delta Golf Lima. He mailed it to me this week. Very well done. For those who really want to get into this, I'll warn you, it's fairly heavy stuff. We can put that on Bernie's website, and you can be looking at it. Now, we got to also remember that whenever there is a standing wave present, if I put a very high standing wave ratio on my slotted line and start evaluating where the E and the H is, now for the first time, they will be in quadrature, in timing. When you've got a wave going north to south and another equal amplitude wave going from south to north in the exact same electromagnetic media, whether it be the TEM wave inside of the slotted line or whether it be a pair of TEM waves in free space, all hell breaks loose as far as the timing of E and H and whatever. In the case of a transmission line, the point of maximum voltage is the point of minimum current in a standing wave. If you have a pure traveling wave, the current everywhere along that transmission line is identical. The magnetic field everywhere along that transmission line is identical if you're talking about what happened over one complete cycle. And if you break it down to 1 degree of one cycle, I am saying that you can measure some magnitude of E, some magnitude of H. They will stay the exact same ratio between the two, no matter where you make the measurement, in time or space or position. So let me, with that philosophy, let me add to what you just said. Let me drop. And by the way, we're about to be stopped in 1 minute. And that is, whether I look at your more complicated diagram at other angles, it is less energy being radiated. Yes, there's going to be a smaller amount of radiation. And assuming now that the wave stays linear, even though it may shift in polarization, if it stays linear, the ratio of E and H, even though they're weaker, they keep the exact same ratio based on 377 ohms. I think that's true. In previous weeks, you and I disagreed on that one. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
We don't disagree on it. They are. But as I said, I mean, what you're saying is absolutely true. When you're looking at a cable and the transmission lines are in phase, let me see if I'm still here. Okay, but what's happening is in free space. You're not in a transmission line anymore. And the majority of the energy at that particular time, being that if there's no mass and you're in vacuum, everything is potential energy. So you don't have the kinetics of a transmission line. So it's a bit different.
Okay. You and I can keep talking this way, and I think we're going to be cut off. Inside of that coaxial cable, it is called a transverse electromagnetic wave. That wave in free space is called a transverse electromagnetic wave. Are you saying those two waves are different? Isn't there in an E and H exactly at right angles to each other in those two environments? And are the E and the H in time synchronous when the peak of one equals the peak of the other in both environments? You seem to be saying that the wave in free space is very different than the wave in that coax cable. Yet they're both called TEM. Is somebody lying? Over to you, Glenn. T-2-L-A-W.
No, they're not. It's just semantics. It's, as I said, when you're looking at the antenna itself, the antenna is going to be looking at a transverse wave. It's going to be taking an area cross-section. It's basically always 90 degrees to the wavefront. So it's always in a cross-section. So at the same time as would be in the cable. So that as far as the antenna is concerned, it's always at maximum and minimum. And on top of that, you also have the fact that the antenna is also in resonance. It's not at 377 ohms. So you have a reinforcement of resonance within the antenna that's also taking place that reestablishes H and E in a portion no matter what.
I've got a disagreement on that one, Glenn. You and I can build a sensing antenna. I'll admit it's not going to be very sensitive, but in a laboratory environment, I can use a 50-ohm resistor as a sensing device. It is broadband as all hell, has no resonance of any kind. As I twist that 50-ohm resistor that I've connected to the end of my coaxial cable, I can measure E field. I can sense polarization. I've got no resonance going on. I can measure what's going on with that 50-ohm resistor. That's a real antenna. It happens to have minus 40 dB of gain, but it's an antenna. It's a very small sensing device, and it's going to give me less Heisenberg uncertainty. I'm going to be doing less disturbance of the pattern that I'm trying to measure with that sensing device. You give me enough amplification on the signal coming out of that 50-ohm resistor, and I'm going to measure what I want to measure in a laboratory environment. Over to you, Glenn. K2LIW.
Yeah, no disagreement there, Dick. The only thing that I was pointing out was that when you have resonance, you're really establishing a reinforced B and H field. That's what I'm really trying to say, is that the resonance itself is reinforcing it, and that's that gain that you're talking about. But do you need the gain to see B and H in phase in a cross-section of a non-resonant receptor? No, absolutely not. You will still be looking at a cross-section, and B and H will still be in phase. But is that truly representative of that measurement point in that cross-section? Is that representative of what the wave is really doing in unabated free phase? No, it's not.
Okay, no, it's not. Then what is it really? What you're saying, those applets are not showing what it is. What it is something else. What is that something else? And if you were generating the more accurate applet, what would it look like? How would you, Glenn? K2LIW?
Okay, back to my sphere again. In which we have a sphere that's basically one wavelength from the center with a ground plane. And what we're going to do is we're going to start rotating that antenna around. So you actually only need, I believe, six positions. That's what typically is done when the measurement is made. And so in other words, you can take, you know, like a true north, south, east, west, and basically get, you know, it's top, bottom, front, back, and I figure with there's actually a six point coordinate system. Are you familiar with the system, Dick?
Most antenna engineers will call it the cardinal plane measurement. And whether or not you're doing a conic section or a great circle cut, you get different results. But the so-called cardinal cut, where if it was a sphere and I take a cut around the equator, I take a cut at the prime meridian from the North Pole to the South Pole, I take another cut from the international dateline, North Pole to South Pole, 90 degrees, and 270 degrees in longitude, I take a north-south cut. So you take each of these great circle cardinal plane cuts, are the words that the antenna people use. I can now do a pretty good job of analyzing that antenna. if I put that device under test inside of a Satomo, the Satomo has got 60